Hello, I'm Neil Schwartzman, sitting in sunny California. This is number 0170 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0170. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Mark Spivak, who is the author of Iconic Spirits, An Intoxicating History.
As I did the research, I realized that these were stories that were completely unknown to the average person. They might have been familiar to people in the industry, but most people were totally unaware of them, including myself. For example, there was something in the first half of the 18th century in England called the gin craze, which was actually the worst case of mass drunkenness in human history. Virtually 15-20% of the population was drunk for almost 50 years.
Eric Akis is the author of Everyone Can Cook Everything. What does he say to people who complain that they don't have enough time to cook?
I think there is a bit of a misconception about how long things take to cook. The other day in the supermarket, I saw a person with a big stack of those frozen macaroni and cheese dinners. So by the time they made it through the till and got home, they could have easily at home made a very simple white sauce, added some cheese, and made the mac and cheese in a skillet recipe that I have in my book. I think some clever marketers have convinced people that it takes a long time to cook, but most dishes you can whip up pretty quickly.
Ron Galletti from Born to Ride TV and Magazine, he's here to talk about stereotypical myths about motorcycle riders.
You know, there's a misconception about motorcycling in general. Can you judge a book by its cover? Heck no, you can't judge a book by its cover. And these days, the demographics of motorcycling is blue collar to white collar to women make up more than a third of the motorcycle community and market. It's the fastest growing market right now.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0170, was Neil Schwartzman, who is a spam fighter. He's actually the spam fighter. You can check out his website at cause.org, and that is spelled CAUCE.org. And that's an acronym which stands for the Coalition Against Unsolicited Commercial Email. That's CAUCE. And thank you very much, Neil, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff on a program also heard on Stitcher's Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Okay, here's a classic case of chutzpah. The former police chief of Bell, California, Randy Adams, has resigned in disgrace after prosecutors charged eight other city officials with looting the municipal budget. Adams had been recruited by the alleged miscreants at a sweetheart salary twice what he made as police chief of a much larger community, that would be Glendale, and his resignation left him with a generous state pension of $240,000 a year. Rather than quietly accept the payout, Adams immediately appealed to the state pension panel, claiming that his one inexplicably rich year in Bell had actually upped his pension to $510,000 a year. In September, with a straight face, Adams pleaded his case to the panel, but 20 times during the questioning invoked his right not to incriminate himself. And again, remember, he was the police chief. Yeah. Has that guy got a pair on him or what? Anyway. You know, one of the best ways to get the Stuff File program is via Stitcher Smart Radio, as I mentioned earlier. It's easy, and you can download the app for free at Stitcher.com. Then you'll be able to hear over 10,000 shows, including this one, streaming on your mobile device. You don't have to download the shows. Now, ain't life grand? That's Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And that Stitcher app is great. You know, there are great apps out there like Stitcher, and then there are others. Let me share with you three other apps that you might question in the Stuff File News. Number one, The Swiss company Black Sox offers an iPhone app that utilizes radio frequency identification chips inserted into socks so they can be automatically sorted. Because apparently we needed that. And we still, by the way, don't have a cure for cancer. I'm just bringing that point up. Number two, the iPoo app, reported Wired magazine in November, lets you chat with your fellow defecators from the comfort of your own toilet. You know, there are some places you really shouldn't be chatting. That's number one on my list. And number three, in development now, according to Harvard freshman Olenka Polak, is a code red app that creates an exchange network so that women and girls who find themselves unexpectedly spotting can locate an emergency source for a tampon or pad. Okay, that last one might be somewhat handy. Moving right along, under the headline of People Different From Us, Gareth Lloyd, age 49, admitted that he is the one who made about 5,800 random phone calls over a 90-day period, that's an average of 64 a day, to people just to listen to their reactions when he told them that his penis was stuck in a household object, usually jars or a vacuum cleaner. A Flintshire, Wales court sentenced Lloyd only to probation with restrictions on telephone use. Okay, how much time on your hands do you have to come up with ideas like this? And by that I mean, anybody can come up with a wacky idea. Heck, that's how creative writing came to be. But it's an entirely different type of brain that wants to execute such ideas. Yikes. Anyway, we have time for one more item in the Stuff File news before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A Texas woman said she was dismayed to discover the iPad she bought for $200 from a man at a gas station turned out to be a mirror with an Apple logo. Jolanta Freeman of Arlington said the man approached her at a gas station with a load of iPads and stuff and offered to sell her an $800 model for only $200, and she took the deal. However, Freeman said her sister later opened the package and discovered it was a mirror with an Apple sticker attached. If you turn it on the back, it actually looks like an Apple iPad, Freeman said, and when you turn it on the front, it had the prices and stuff. That's so messed up, Freeman said. That's so wrong. I would never do anything like that. Get a job. She's a little angry, isn't she? Yeah. Arlington police spokeswoman Tiara Richard said no similar crimes have been reported in the area recently, but it's a common occurrence near the holiday season. Now, Miss Freeman is incensed and upset about what has happened to her. Now, I have no intention of siding with the con artist because, let's face it, he's a sleazeball. But Ms. Freeman is both gullible and greedy because she wanted an $800 value for a quarter of the price, and she was willing to purchase it from a stranger who walked up to her at a gas station. This story can turn out one of two ways. It's either a con or the guy is dealing in stolen property. I'm willing to bet that Jolanta thought it was probably the latter and that she was going to take a gamble. So I'm sorry, but she got what she deserved. It's either that, or I make her the idiot of the day. But I won't, because that comes later. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Spivak is a wine and spirits editor for the Palm Beach Media Group, and he's also a restaurant critic. He knows some of the little-known stories of the 12 most influential spirits that changed the face of the cocktail culture, and he's written about it in his book, Iconic Spirits, An Intoxicating History. Mark joins us on the line right now from Florida. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So you've written this book, and you've uncovered these stories about the cocktail culture. Since you're somebody who writes about this on a regular basis, was there anything in doing your research that surprised you when you were putting this book together?
Absolutely. As I did the research, I realized that these were stories that were completely unknown to the average person. They might have been familiar to people in the industry, but most people were totally unaware of them, including myself. For example, there was something in the first half of the 18th century in England called the gin craze, which was actually the worst case of mass drunkenness in human history. Virtually 15-20% of the population was drunk for almost 50 years.
Wow.
It totally spiraled out of control, and almost brought down the British Empire. And this is something I had never heard of before.
How did they rectify that situation?
Well, eventually there was a drought and the price of grain went up and gin became too expensive for most people to buy, which took care of it on its own. But it was really a pretty amazing story, because in the first half of the 18th century, there were something like 90,000 houses in London, and 15,000 of those houses had a room set aside for the sale and consumption of gin. They had people pushing wheelbarrows down the street selling gin to folks that were too drunk to actually stagger into one of these gin shops. So industrial output was dropping, the birth rate was dropping. It was really turned into a very serious situation.
And it sounds like they were drinking this stuff basically like water.
Yes, and of course the problem was that most of the population went from drinking beer that had an alcohol content of maybe 5 or 6% and still had some hydration value to drinking something that was really 40% alcohol, and they just could not handle it.
Now, one of the things that I found interesting in checking some information about your book is that moonshiners and NASCAR have a connection.
Yes, this is something that NASCAR has been conscientious about obscuring, because they want to promote the sport as good, clean family entertainment. But the reality is that almost all of the early drivers were bootleggers. They were guys that were constantly working on their cars to be able to outrun the revenue agents. And at a certain point, they started racing informally among themselves, and then in 1947, they got together and founded NASCAR. So I went to North Carolina, and I interviewed a guy by the name of Junior Johnson, who is in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. And he was also a legendary bootlegger, and he told me some amazing stories.
Wow. Now, I would assume that prohibition plays a role in all of this, and especially, and I'm talking to you from Canada, where we didn't have prohibition, but we certainly benefited from it.
Yes, and in fact, I did go to Windsor, and I spent about 3 days with the folks at Canadian Club, and did a lot of research about prohibition and the impact of it in Canada versus the U.S. And, of course, in Canada, as you know, you were not breaking any laws. And distilling was a large business, and basically they could not afford to abandon the entire industry because of what was happening in America.
And there was also a story, I understand, about a homeless guy who became one of the wealthiest people in America. How did he do that?
Well, we're talking about John Paul DeGioia, who grew up as an orphan, was in a street gang in East Los Angeles, and was actually homeless twice in his life. And today he is number 66 on the Forbes list of the 400 wealthiest Americans. And where it started was he founded a company called John Paul Mitchell Systems, which you might have heard of, which is a hair products company. He started it with a friend of his by the name of Paul Mitchell. And they started it with a $700 investment, $350 each. And at the time he started that, he was actually homeless. He was living out of his car. Became very wealthy from that, and from there went on to found Patron Tequila.
Now, in doing your research, do you ever look into the drinking habits of certain people, certain groups, certain social classes?
Well, I think that surfaced naturally, obviously, in the chapter on the gin craze it did, and certainly in the chapter on absinthe. That was a big factor, because absinthe was regarded in France as the most dangerous substance on earth. I call it the LSD of the 19th century. And I think the wine lobby had a great deal to do with the ban of absinthe in France.
And also, there is a surprise as to basically who the cognac drinkers are in the United States.
Yes, this is quite amazing as well. Something like 2/3 of the cognac in the U.S. is sold in hip-hop clubs. Clubs that cater to African Americans and that have rap entertainment.
Now, why do you think that is?
Well, basically, in the 90s, you had a very severe recession in Asia, which was the largest market at the time for cognac. And globally, sales of cognac went down 15 or 20%, and the whole region was in a crisis. And this started spontaneously because basically whenever you have a locus of new wealth that pops up anywhere in the world, the people who become suddenly wealthy want the same things. They want the luxury brands that will announce to other people that they have arrived. And one of those luxury brands in the case of rap artists was cognac. Another was champagne, of course. So they started mentioning it in songs and including it in videos, and it really took off. It became a symbol of wealth and prosperity in that community.
Well, I mentioned in the introduction 12 most influential spirits. I'm guessing that it can be, over a period of time, a bit of a horse race between them. Have they changed in popularity over the years, and is one more popular than others from different time periods?
Well, in the 70s and 80s, you'll recall, vodka was extremely popular. It goes in cycles. You know, whiskey was traditionally extremely popular in the boom periods of the cocktail culture. And one of those, of course, was the 40s and 50s. Then it went out of style. Vodka became all the rage. And now, of course, brown spirits are coming back. And that, believe it or not, that was largely fueled by the Japanese. The Japanese market was actually responsible for the current resurgence in bourbon.
Is part of it a generational thing? And by that I mean, you know, people from a certain generation like a certain type of alcohol, and the next generation comes along and wants to find or discover something of their own, something that their mom or dad doesn't drink. Does that have an effect?
Exactly. And in this case, I think we've come full circle, because I think you have a young group of mixologists in the U.S. who are basically reviving, they're going back to what their grandparents drank. They're going back to the classic prohibition and post-prohibition cocktails. And they're looking for the most dramatic flavors they can, which is why they're looking for bourbon, scotch, and other types of whiskey.
And what are the companies doing that manufacture these alcohols? What are they doing to entice that new audience?
Some of them are just doing extraordinary levels of bartender outreach. They really cultivate the bartenders in key markets and in the most popular bars. And they spend a lot of time and effort and energy and money getting the attention of those people and getting placements in those bars.
Now, I understand that Grey Goose Vodka, you mentioned vodka earlier, started the advent of premium spirits. But you say people shouldn't always pay premium for certain ones.
Well, I would say particularly in the case of vodka, because you have to remember that vodka is essentially manufactured. You make it today, you sell it tomorrow. And it doesn't cost anything to age it. And yet most of the premium and super premium vodkas are selling in the range of $30 to $40. And in a lot of cases, there's nothing to justify that price except the image or where the producer wants to position that particular brand. And you're right, this all goes back to Sidney Frank. Sidney Frank wanted to create a super premium spirit, which didn't really exist at the time. So what he did was he created Grey Goose and basically took the price of Absolut, which was the most expensive vodka on the market at that time, and doubled it. There was no necessary reason for it to sell for twice as much. It didn't cost twice as much to produce, but he created a certain aura of exclusivity and connoisseurship.
The book is called Iconic Spirits, An Intoxicating History, and it certainly is an intoxicating education into the world of spirits. I thank you very, very much, Mark, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, it was fun. Thank you.
Mark Spivak, author of Iconic Spirits, An Intoxicating History. You can check out his website at iconicspirits.net. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0170, and you'll find links to his site. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook.
There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Everyone Can Cook Everything, plus Ron Galletti, who is from Born to Ride TV and Magazine. Plus, of course, there's an idiot of the day. Stick around for that. But right now, more Stuff File news on the Stuff File program. Also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. The Red Flower Chinese restaurant in Williamsburg, Kentucky, was shut down by health authorities in September after a customer said he witnessed a roadkill deer carcass being wheeled through the dining room into the kitchen. The Chief Whitley County Health Inspector said the owners did not appear to understand that they shouldn't do that. That's correct, because if they did know they shouldn't do that, they would have wheeled it directly from the back door. But I digress. Yeah, check please. And we have a story for the Darwin File here, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Edward Archibald, age 32, died in October following his victory at the bug-eating contest sponsored by the Ben Siegel Reptile Store in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Archibald, described by friends as a life-of-the-party type of person, had stuffed handfuls of insects into his mouth, which people do harmlessly around the world in various cultures, but collapsed a short time later. Oopsie. A moment of silence. Okay, that's enough. Among the most creative illegal behaviors are those of clever smugglers or immigrants trying to enter a country illegally. Now, in September, two Moroccans tried to smuggle a Ghanaian man into Spain at the Melilla border in north Morocco by disguising him as a Renault car seat. One Moroccan drove with the passenger perched on the seat in which the foam had been removed to make room for the Ghanaian. A police spokesman called the attempt novel. Gee, don't you kind of think creativity should earn some sort of entry points? I mean, come on. Anyway. India's notorious bureaucracy records death particularly ineptly to the advantage of men seeking an alternative to divorce. They find it easier merely to swear out a death certificate on one wife so they can marry another, but that means the first wife will face years or maybe decades of campaigning to convince officials that she is indeed still breathing and upright. BBC News chronicled the plight of one Ms. Arsharfi Devi, now 64, in September, as she was finally declared alive after being deserted by her husband at age 23 and ruled dead at age 40. After Devi finally earned a hearing and brought relatives and evidence to the village council, deliberations took 8 more months. Wow. Notwithstanding the ruling, the husband stuck to his story. I'm wondering, if she then killed him, would she have to go to jail? I mean, she was legally dead. Can dead people commit capital crimes? It's a theory. A theory someone might want to try. Okay, puzzling adults continue to accidentally ingest improbable objects, often seemingly unaware of what they did. Lee Gardner, age 40, of Barnsley, England, swallowed a plastic fork 10 years ago, but said he forgot about it until violent stomach pains forced him to the hospital in August. And British student Georgie Smith, age 19, became the latest person to accidentally swallow a regular-sized toothbrush, though the first doctor she consulted told her he couldn't spot any toothbrush on the X-ray. Now, with kids, the phenomenon is more understandable. Sinus-suffering Isaac Lassen, age 6, of Salt Lake City, Utah, was finally diagnosed in August to have accidentally stuck a Lego piece in his nose about 3 years ago. And Hector Flores Jr., age 7, of New York City, was found in October to have swallowed a whistle mechanism of a plastic duck, causing him to tweet when he laughed. Now, gee, you almost don't want to take that last one out, don't you? Anyway, moving right along, Darren Hyber, age 33, became the most recent person to choose drastic means to reconcile with an ex. Twice, Hyber of Onawa, Iowa, arranged to have himself shot in order to win his ex-wife's sympathy. The first hitman shot Hyber in the leg, but his wife still ignored him. Wow, that's a cold woman, huh? And a second job was arranged in March with two different shooters, but that failed also. And adding to his frustration, Hyber was sentenced to 10 years in prison in August because apparently it's illegal in Iowa to have yourself shot. Wow. Love is blind and sometimes stupid. Yeesh. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, David Weber, age 53, was arrested in Miami Beach in September, minutes after allegedly stealing items from a locked car, including a credit card. Now, police were called when Weber tried to use the credit card at a nearby bar and learned to his dismay that the card belonged to the bartender. Ouch. Oh, that's just another example that there is a God, and he indeed does have a sense of humor. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Eric Akis is a well-renowned food journalist whose columns appear in newspapers across Canada. He's also the author of Everyone Can Cook Everything, which is his seventh book. And Eric joins us on the line right now from British Columbia. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So right off, let's start with the title. I mean, I think we all know some folks who are kitchen impaired, some people who can't make ice cubes without a recipe. So are you sure everyone can cook?
Yes. To me, it's more about confidence, inspiration, and desire. You know, it's like with anything you do, if there's a will, there is a way. And I'm hoping that my book will inspire more people to take up the challenge if they're feeling like they can't make toast or something difficult like that.
Now, for one of the things that concerns some people who, when it comes to cooking, is not so much what they can or cannot do, but in this day and age, people are concerned about time.
Right. I think there is a bit of a misconception about how long things take to cook. For example, I have a lovely maple whiskey glazed salmon recipe in my book that takes 12 to 15 minutes to cook and about 5 minutes to prepare. So you can have a lovely piece of fish on your table in about 20 minutes. So that doesn't take very long. The other day in the supermarket, I saw a person with a big stack of those frozen macaroni and cheese dinners.
Right.
So by the time they made it through the till and got home, they could have easily at home made a very simple white sauce, added some cheese, and made the mac and cheese in a skillet recipe that I have in my book. So I think some clever marketers have convinced people that it takes a long time to cook, but most dishes you can whip up pretty quickly. Even a small roast of pork that's a pound and a half will only take about 30 to 40 minutes to cook in the oven. So So there are a lot of things you can do if you just give it a shot.
Well, I think you just answered my next question, and that is it just the marketing genius of companies to make us believe that we don't have the time to do this kind of thing?
Well, there is an ad out right now. I won't mention the company, but it's a pizza chain, and where the dad is doing finger cooking on the internet because it's just too much trouble to cook at home, so he can order in some, you know, salt-laden lasagna from the store when at home it really isn't that difficult if you just put your mind to it.
So what are the types of things you can find in your cookbook? I would assume there is a variety of foods one can find in the book, right?
Well, with the title, Everyone Can Cook Everything, my goal was to include, anything from breakfast. I have a morning glory pancake recipe for light and fluffy pancakes you can make on a Saturday morning. There is some really nice soups that you can make on a Tuesday night, like a quick tomato soup with pesto and feta. It uses 6 or 7 ingredients and takes no time to prepare. You could serve it with some pita bread, and you could make a nice light supper that way. I've done some also special occasion meals that, but again, they won't stress you out. One is called Roast Cornish Hens Glazed with Maple and Dijon. That sounds kind of fancy, but it's actually just some Cornish hens that you cut in half. That's not hard to do. You roast them and you glaze them with a simple glaze of maple syrup and Dijon mustard and some fresh sage. And then, of course, there's tons of cookies and squares and those kind of simple sweets. And then some adult desserts, such as banana flambé with rum and pecans, you know, for the adults on a late Friday night party.
Now, in the introduction, I mentioned that you are a food journalist, but I failed to mention at the time that besides that, you are a professional chef, a trained professional chef, and pastry chef. Some of the things you talk about in the book, I would assume part of the problem with today's world is people used to learn things at home. You learned how to cook from what your mom or dad cooked, and it was passed down and it was passed down. And that just doesn't seem to be happening these days.
It's not. And you know what I think's taken over? And this is an example of with my son. He's a big fan of the Food Network, and I see more and more young people cooking after they've watched, you know, Michael Smith cook something on the Food Network. They feel like they have the confidence, which I think that's kind of inspiring. So I think that's been the kind of shift. But even so, I think when people are starting to learn to cook, they need to try and choose recipes that still match their skill set. For example, if you're not the greatest at chopping, which a lot of novice cooks aren't, it might not be a good idea to choose a recipe that requires 12 things chopped, julienne or something like that. So try and pick out recipes that that you can read over and look at and say, you know what, I think I can handle that. And that'll give you confidence and want to try other things that are more complicated later on.
Well, as you say, if you're not really sure what your skill level is at, I mean, one of the things that is difficult for a novice cook is to know what is above his or her attempt to cook.
That's true. That's why in my particular book, I try and anticipate as many questions as possible. So, for example, that salmon recipe I was speaking of, next to it I say, how to tell when fish is cooked. Here are some tips to understand how the fish transformed from being raw to what it looks like when it's cooked. For salmon, for example, you'll see a little bit of fat seeping out between the flakes. When the fish is raw, it feels soft. When it's cooked, it feels a bit firmer. When it's not quite cooked, it still feels a little bit soft in the middle. So I try and offer some hints like that. So that if you're not quite sure of something, there will be the answer in the book to help you along.
Now, how do you feel about oven versus microwave?
For me, a microwave is something to heat or thaw. That's kind of where I go with that. The texture, microwaves kind of cook from the center out, and they don't do justice to a lot of things. So if you made a soup recipe in the book and you froze some for later use, the microwave is a good place to reheat it. And that's kind of what I use it for.
Some things that people are a little bit afraid of, even those who like to cook, the slow cooker.
Yes. I'd have to say I'm a slow cooker convert, and that occurred because my readers were asking for recipes, and I was like, everything up until that time, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, kind of tasted like water that came out of it. And the reason that is, the longer stuff cooks in a slow cooker, steam rises, hits the lid, and it basically dilutes what you're cooking in the pot. And if you looked at some older slow cooker recipes, the cooking time would be 10 to 12 hours. And that was simply because the idea was in the morning you turn the slow cooker on and you come home from work and your stuff's ready. But the truth is that most foods in a slow cooker will only take 6 to 8 hours to cook till things are cooked through and flavorful. And at that point, things are really rich tasting. But if you kept cooking it for another 4 hours, like a simple vegetarian stew, it would taste more like water than the tomatoes and spices and vegetables that you put in the pot.
I don't know how busy your work week is. Are you the kind of person who cooks a lot on the weekend and reheats during the week, or do you cook little things through the course of the week, or what do you recommend?
I have a bit of an unusual life in that I work at home, and my job is basically testing recipes every day. So I also do consulting for a grocery store chain out here called Thrifty Foods. That's part of the Sobeys chain. And I do 4 recipes for them and about 3 or 4 for the newspaper in my 2 columns a week. So I'm pretty much testing and eating as I go along. But when I do that, I do think about someone who actually has a real job and is out there and comes home at 6 o'clock. And that's where I like to offer tips on, like you suggested, maybe cooking a lasagna on the weekend. Say there's only 2 of you at home, and how to freeze the rest of it into portions so you can come home on a Tuesday night and have a nice lasagna dinner. I do the same thing with stews and soups and desserts. So I do think about that, although in my own situation, I'm kind of lucky in that I'm cooking in a storm up every day, pretty much.
Now, for you, what is a favorite dish? And what I mean by favorite dish, something that makes you salivate with anticipation while you're making it?
I'm a big fan of soups, especially out here when it's raining, a foot of rain overnight or something like that. And one recipe in the book I have is hot and sour soup with scallops and ginger. And just the aroma of that soup, of that sweet and sour aroma, it just makes me feel good when I look outside and wonder if I'm going to have to build an ark. So that's one recipe for sure. Another one is there's a recipe in the book called Easy Roll Ginger Cookies, and I'm a big fan of spices like ginger. And when those are cooking, I put on a pot of tea, and when they come out of the oven, they're just something that is really wonderful.
Excellent. The book is called Everyone Can Cook Everything. It's written by Eric Akis, and you can check out the website, everyonecancook.com. Eric, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Eric Akis, author of Everyone Can Cook Everything. You can check out his website at everyonecancook.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0170, and you'll find links to his site. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As Americans celebrate Thanksgiving this week, many children around the nation will learn about the Pilgrims and Native Americans for the first time. Some will hear about how a Native American named Squanto helped the Pilgrims survive. They may even talk about whether Squanto should be called a Native American or an Indian. Let's be fair, answering that question isn't easy. Nearly 400 years after Squanto died, we're still debating how to treat Native Americans with the respect they deserve. Just this year, a judge ruled that the University of North Dakota's sports teams can no longer use a Native American nickname. Now, lawsuits challenging the use of Native American nicknames in sports have become common, but this lawsuit was different. In this case, a Native American tribe sued to force the college to keep its Indian nickname. After losing, the tribe now fears that many Americans will simply forget about them. This Thanksgiving, learn more about this and about how lawsuits are changing America. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk about bikers, and we have an idiot of the day, but I got one more Stuff File story to share with you before we get to our last guest on this edition of The Stuff File program. A man went into an auto parts store in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and bought a crowbar and a sledgehammer. He declined the receipt. He said, "When I'm done with these, no one else will want them back." In the parking lot, he started taking out his frustrations on a car that was parked there, and police were summoned. They arrived to find him standing on the roof, bashing the car, which was a black hearse with a skull and crossbones front license plate. But he wasn't arrested. You see, it was his own vehicle, and he promised to clean up after himself. He had the salvage company on the way for it, so he just wanted to get his licks in before it went, according to a police sergeant. "He just wanted to give it a goodbye, I guess," said the cop. Yeah. Note to his girlfriend, if he says he wants to break up, run. That's my advice to you. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Time to break out a stereotype about motorcycles. The one where women are merely an accessory to a guy and his motorcycle, as opposed to women who like to ride themselves. On the line with us right now is Ron Galletti. He, along with his wife Debbie, are biker lifestyle experts and the producers of Born to Ride magazine and also the accompanying TV show. Both of them were supposed to be on with us to chat, but I think we've lost Debbie. However, we do have Ron, and he's on the line with us right now from Florida. Hi, Ron.
How are you guys doing today? It's great to be here on your show, and I really appreciate you having me today.
My pleasure. It's too bad we couldn't have Debbie on with us as well, but we still want to talk about the issue of women and motorcycles. You know, you hear about motorcycles, you hear about women, there's a stereotype, there's an image, but that's not necessarily correct, is it?
Well, I'm telling you, I'm sorry Debbie couldn't be out here right now, but she's out on her motorcycle and she hasn't got back yet, so she should be back soon, hopefully. And, you know, Deb's a rider, and, you know, there's a misconception about motorcycling in general, you know. Can you judge a book by its cover? Heck no, you can't judge a book by its cover. And these days, the demographics of motorcycling is blue-collar to white-collar to women make up more than a third of the motorcycle community and market. It's the fastest-growing market right now. There's also the trikes, three-wheel motorcycles, where you can ride till you're 99 years old or 100. So, and then you have people of color, from the Asians to Latinos, to the blacks. I mean, everybody's riding today, and it's such a cool thing because motorcycling is a part of the world and Americana, and it's just a great thing.
Isn't part of the change in the demographics of motorcycling, doesn't that have a lot to do with, quite frankly, the baby boomer generation? And the reason why I bring that up, it used to be before the baby boomers, people did certain things and did what they was expected of them for their age group. And riding a motorcycle was something that you did when you were younger, but not when you were older. And baby boomers, they kind of express life and live life to the fullest, and they don't think about what they have to do when they grow up, per se.
Well, yeah, you're right. It's now, you know, when you have an indisposable income when you're older, you have maybe more money to spend. When you're younger, you need transportation. Before I was in high school, I bought my first motorcycle because it was a more inexpensive way to be transported. So I bought a Suzuki 750, and I learned how to ride that motorcycle, and I survived in my younger years. Because when you're young and you're riding, you're kind of stupid and you don't have enough respect for the road. But if you have a little bit or get a little smart, you can stay alive. And when you get a little older, you tend to be a little more conservative, a little smarter on the road. And it's very important to ride safe and ride smart and stay alive, because the mean streets out there, it's not only someone who doesn't see you, it's the people who are riding too fast on the bad road conditions and don't respect the road. So motorcycling, it's such an amazing fun. Could be a sport. It could be a part of your lifestyle. You know, it's just a fun thing to do. And, you know, you could travel and adventure, and it takes you places. And there's nothing like riding a motorcycle. No matter what you ride, people, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a Harley. It could be any kind of motorcycle out there. As long as you're riding and the camaraderie, and you're feeling the brotherhood and the sisterhood, and it's amazing. You'll pull over on a roadside stop, and there'll be another biker there, and you just say, how you doing? They say, how are you doing? Next thing you know, you're going, really? I used to live there. Oh, I've been there. Oh, yeah, let me get your email. Come back by my house if you're ever in the area. And you just made a friend, you know? So motorcycling is such a great thing, and women in motorcycling, it's great to see more women not on the back of the motorcycle. They're riding, they're buying, they have a big part of our market share and the marketplace, and the baby boomer generation, you're right, is a big part of that.
Now, you mentioned that you bought your first motorcycle when you were a teenager. Now, I know a lot of guys, when I was a teenager, wanted to get a motorcycle, and the one thing that stopped them from doing it, quite frankly, mom. She wouldn't have anything to do with it. I know a lot of guys who couldn't get anywhere near a motorcycle because their mom said no. How did your parents feel about you getting a motorcycle?
Well, you're completely right with that, and I'm really thinking as a dad, I don't need my son to be riding a motorcycle either, or my daughter, and they're 10 and 11 right now. But I started out with dirt bikes and mini bikes and rode them constantly in the dirt for hours and hours every day and on the weekend. So I started learning how to ride. But it's about a mindset, and you have to be smart on a motorcycle. You have to think smart, and you have to stay alive out there because everybody's out to get you. And if they don't get you, you get yourself in trouble. So my mom trusted me. She just let me go, man. She let me do it, and I came back every day. You know, and I came back again and again and again, and I started my own biker TV show. I liked it so much, you know. There was a lull. I quit. I stopped riding. I got rid of my bike. I got into this heavy metal band, Nasty Savage, in the 80s. We toured all over the place. Then I got into pro wrestling. And I was a co-producer of over 200 episodes of the IWF Wrestling at Universal Studios. And then I was also working in this as a shop foreman in this warehouse, and all my friends started riding motorcycles. And this was about 1992 or so. And I said, you know what? They were all riding, so I wanted to ride again. I went and bought a Harley. And then a little while later, my wife Debbie got one. Because she used to ride as a kid as well, dirt bikes, with her mom and dad. And all of a sudden, I started putting the bikes in bike shows and putting more stuff on them in chrome. And I was like, damn, we didn't win that show? I'm upset. I can't believe we didn't win that $10 trophy or something. So I said, hold on a minute. I'm fanatical about this. She's fanatical. He's fanatical. There's fanatical people about motorcycling. There's no documentation of motorcycle. There's no proper documentation of the biker lifestyle, so I'm going to start a motorcycle TV show, and I'm going to call it Born to Ride. And you know what? The .com was there. This was like 1995, 94. Next thing you know, I was in Daytona Beach at Bike Week 95, and I was cutting promos for a demo tape, and I was saying, and we'll be right back after word from our sponsors. I didn't even have a sponsor, but I had a vision. And I knew this would work. And here I am 17 years later. In January, I'll produce my 900th episode of Born to Ride TV. Is that incredible or what?
That is very incredible. So what will one find? What's a typical situation one will see on an episode of Born to Ride TV?
Well, Born to Ride is the life and times of motorcycles and the people who ride them. So, I mean, I could almost spin that anyway. But a lot of times we cover events that we market and promote that are Born to Ride events. Like we just did a trilogy of our 17-year anniversary parties in three different big places. Or it might be the Ride for Kids, focusing on Pediatric Brain Tumor Foundation. Or it might be a ride for the Shriners Hospital and the Burn Center for Children. Or it might be a Bikers Against Child Abuse ride that we did in Orlando, Harley-Davidson. Or, you know, it could be a profile on a special person, or, it could be dirt bikes, motocross. You know, we travel, we go to Sturgis, we take adventures, and we have destination points. We might be a five-star hotel or resort that we stay at, and we want to highlight what's around the rally in Knoxville, Tennessee, and we go up in the mountains and learn, teach people about, you know, nature and the things to do while you're whitewater rafting close to the rally. Really, it's about people. And Born to Ride is about the motorcycle community. There's a lot of great people doing great things. So we want to magnify the great things bikers do and the fun, the family aspect, the industry aspect, the cutting-edge technology, what's hot in the industry, news, newsworthy items, celebrity stuff. And, you know, we've had a lot of big celebrities on the show over the years. We have Hulk Hogan, Willie Nelson, Evel Knievel, Charlie Daniels, all kinds of wrestlers and TV stars. But, you know, some of the people ask me, what's the biggest star you've ever had on Born to Ride? I'll say, you know what? The people I'm the most proud of is that little boy that we helped get a kidney. And he was in the hospital and he had no fear because he didn't know fear. Or the Special Olympics child that won that medal. He was so proud. And the bikers helped raise money for him. And that kid never knew a bad day because he was always smiling and having fun. You know, you can learn a lot from the people's adversities. And when you help others, you know, that's our job, is to help others in life. And when I have the power of media, I choose to help others with it when we can. The Born to Ride magazine is much more than photos on paper, man. It's about passion. It's about emotion. And it's a roller coaster ride with the TV show of emotion, take you up and down. It might make you cry. It might make you laugh. But we're going to definitely take you on a traveling trip. It's sort of like watching the show Cops. It's the fastest half hour on TV. When it's done, you want more.
People can find out more information by going to your website, which is borntoride.com, correct?
Correct, man. I tell you what, people, if you're listening right now, motorcycling is what it's all about. And if you like us on Facebook right now, I will send the first 10 people that likes us on Facebook that heard it on this show a Born to Ride t-shirt.
Excellent.
How do you like that, guys?
Excellent.
We want to give back to you. We want you to be riding. We want to hear your motorcycle stories. Just tell us what you think, man. It's all about fun. And women make up such a big part of motorcycling. It's another thing. Born to Ride isn't out to disrespect women. You know, women are in powerful places in the workplace and in the marketplace. And it's so important just to enjoy what we all do. You know, I was at a bike night the other night. I hate to ramble on, but I was at a bike night the other night. A bike night is where all these people come together at a night spot. And this middle-aged woman came up to me, probably about 60 years old, and she goes, "You're Ron Galletti." She goes, "I've been watching your TV show for years." She goes, "But I never thought I could be a biker." She goes, "Because I work in a bank, and I'm pretty high up there." And she goes, "But come here." And she grabs my shirt. She goes, "Come here." She goes, "This is my motorcycle, and this is my husband's. We got bikes." And she was so excited. I felt her passion, man. I felt her excitement. And that's what Born to Ride is all about.
Thank you very much, Ron.
You're more than welcome. Debbie is still out there on the road somewhere, and I'm sure she'll be looking forward to talking to you again soon and instead of me. So Debbie's a lot more mellow and down to earth, and she's not so excited all the time like I am.
Ron Galletti from Born to Ride, both the TV show and the magazine. You can visit their website at borntoride.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0170, and you'll find links to their site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
IRS agents investigating tax fraud suspect Rashia Wilson, age 26, turned up thousands of identification numbers in a September home search in Tampa. Now, Wilson had already laid down a challenge in May when she wrote on Facebook, "I'm Rashia, the queen of IRS tax fraud. I'm a millionaire, for the record, so if you think that indicting me will be easy, it won't. I promise you, I won't do no dumb time. Bleep, bleep, bleep." Yeah. The search also turned up a handgun, and since Wilson is a convicted felon with 40 arrests, she was jailed and denied bail in part because of the Facebook post. Yeah. Why would someone who is swindling money out of Uncle Sam taunt the IRS on Facebook, no less, especially when they've had 40 arrests and there's a handgun on the premises? Well, one reason and one reason only. She's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0170. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0170. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mama jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.